Athanaric was king of the Visigoths. They were in the region of modern-day Spain. He reigned during the 360s and 370s AD. He decreed all people in his kingdom must sacrifice to the pagan gods and eat meat which had been offered to idols. And he did this to expose the Christians so that he would have an excuse to put them to death. And some of the unchristians, the non-Christians in his kingdom, had pity on the Christians and tried to protect them. They offered Christians meat, which had not been offered to idols, while also telling the magistrates that it had been consecrated to the gods. And a Christian man named Sabbas knew the Bible's command against eating meat offered to idols was as much about giving the appearance of participating in idolatry as it was about participating in idolatry. And to eat meat that everyone thought was offered to idols was to disobey the Bible command. And so Sabbas refused to obey the king's command or eat the meat offered to him under the guise of compassion. He was arrested, and he was forced to walk the long distance from the place of his arrest to where he would be tried. On the journey, the soldiers who arrested him pierced him repeatedly with thorns and briars, and they beat him almost continually. When they reached a place where they were stopping for the night, they suspended him between two beams. They tied his legs to one beam and his arms to the other and hung him between them. The lady of the house had compassion on him, and during the night she came and she cut him down. The next day, Sabbas was pressured anew to eat the meat that had been offered to idols. He refused and was immediately executed by drowning. I read accounts like that, and I marvel at the valor of Christians who are willing to endure suffering, torture, and death rather than disobey God. I am so grateful we do not face those tortures here. But do you ever wonder why those who were killed for being Christians did not find a way out? Why didn't Sabbas just eat the meat? Why didn't he work out some other way? What kind of person can remain faithful in the face of agony and death? Daniel 3 is the familiar story of three men who were willing to suffer terrible torment rather than disobey God. At the end of chapter 2, after Daniel had told Nebuchadnezzar his dream and its interpretation, the king promoted Daniel to be one of his closest advisors. In fact, it says at the end of chapter 2 that Daniel was promoted to sit in the gate of the king. Now, that does not mean that Daniel literally sat at the gate of the king's palace. That phrase is an idiom. The English idiom, go the extra mile, means to put in extra effort, to do more than you have to do for something. The ancient idiom, in the gate of the king, meant to serve the king directly. So Daniel was placed in a high position where he served Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel also asked the king to give his three friends positions in the government. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were made officials in the province of Babylon. And sometime later, and we don't know when, it's probably several years later, Nebuchadnezzar built an image of gold near the city of Babylon. And so verse 1 of Daniel chapter 3 says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So this image that Nebuchadnezzar built was massive, but it was oddly proportioned. It was about 90 feet tall, but only 9 feet wide. So very tall and skinny. It may have been an oddly distorted human shape. We have some archaeological evidence of tall, skinny, funny-looking statues. It may have been a towering structure like an obelisk, like the Washington Monument. We don't know exactly what this image looked like. We do know it would have been stunningly beautiful. It was massive. It towered over everything else on that landscape. And its golden skin shone in the sunlight. Now, I don't think we need to imagine this as a piece of solid gold. In fact, it would be millions of pounds worth of gold if it was solid gold. It very likely, in fact, we have biblical and historical evidence that these golden figures were framed out of wood and then covered with sheets of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar had this impressive image built, and then he commanded the officials in charge of the various provinces to attend the dedication of the image. And so Daniel 3 tells us the satraps, administrators, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all officials over the provinces of his kingdom were called. That list of who is called is given in the second verse, and then it is repeated in the third verse to tell who came to the dedication. All who were called to the dedication of that idol attended. And the length of the list and its duplication is given to impress the reader with the magnificence of Nebuchadnezzar. Everything in these first seven verses is just a weightiness of the moment, but the weightiness of the magnificence of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom and the statue which he had built. He ruled over many important governors and judges and officials. And then we have this list of all of these instruments that were played. It shows us he was the mighty king who was able to afford a great number of musicians with all of these instruments. It tells us that he called that there were people from all peoples and nations and languages. He didn't just rule over a lot of people. He ruled over a lot of people from all around the world. He had his service, all manner of governing officials. He had at his service all kinds of musicians. He had wealth to build this massive statue. He had power to rule many powerful people. And Nebuchadnezzar is presented here to us as a great and powerful king who is able to give great homage to his gods. This list in verses 2 and 3, though, also answers a question which troubles many who read this chapter. I'm guessing you're all familiar with the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. You know exactly where all of this is going. If you've thought through the story, you probably wondered, where was Daniel? Why wasn't he there supporting his three friends? Part of the answer to that is those called to bow before the image were provincial officials. It seems to be the satraps and all who were under them. And so these are officials over the king's territories. Daniel was not that kind of official. He was one of the king's closest wise men and advisors. So he wasn't actually in that list that's given as those who are called to do homage to the king's idol. This does not take place in Babylon, but somewhere near it. Maybe we don't actually know exactly where, but somewhere near, but a little ways away from the city of Babylon. We do not know if Nebuchadnezzar brought his entire court with him when he traveled. He very well could have left some trusted ministers at home, including Daniel. We don't know. It doesn't tell us. But this chapter gives us no reason to think that Daniel was present at the dedication of this idolatrous image. My opinion, he's back in Babylon doing his job, or maybe he had been sent off to some other portion of the country in the service of the king. We don't know, but those are my best guesses, if you want to say that. The king gives a very simple command. He tells his herald to command this great body of officials that are gathered in the plain of Dura. The orchestra is about to play, and when they heard the music, everyone was to bow before the image. Those who refused to bow would be immediately thrown into the fire. And this, what's going on here, is a public dedication of the king's idol. This was also a public test of loyalty to the king. And it's also a public display of their civic mindedness. I'll explain that in just a second. But what was at stake here was one's submission to Nebuchadnezzar, devotion to the gods, and concern for the nation. Because worship of the pagan gods, the gods of Babylon, was necessary for the well-being of the empire. And the pagan gods did not require love and obedience in the same way that the God of the Bible does. However, they did require offerings, and failure to give them honor and homage would anger them, and it would bring their wrath on the nation. And so if people refused to worship this idol, the gods might punish the people with famine or disease or war. So failure to bow before Nebuchadnezzar's idol threatens the well-being of the entire state. And for a government official to refuse to bow was rebellion against the king as well as dereliction of duty. And so the orchestra leader raised his arms, and with a flourish, the band begins to play. And everyone gathered before the image began to bow. They fell down and paid homage to the king's idol. Now, I think we can safely assume that there are at least 1,000 people gathered before this idol. We know from Daniel chapter 6 that the Persian Empire had 120 satraps. A satrap was the highest official over a province. Now, Babylon did have fewer provinces, so they would have had fewer satraps. But it is not out of the question that there would have been at least several dozen satraps ruling the provinces of the Babylonian Empire. And each satrap was served by a large staff of officials under him: administrators, counselors, judges, governors, treasurers, magistrates, and so forth. So every province may have sent dozens of officials to the dedication of this idol. Again, if you can picture the impressiveness of the scene, you're in this great plain of Dura. There's this massive golden statue. This orchestra begins to play, and the crowd of people falls on their faces before the statue, and they begin to worship this towering 9-story figure. But not everybody in that crowd bowed before the king's idol. 3 men were unmoved by the image, the music, the crowd, the king's command, or even the threat of death. Now, the crowd was large enough that Nebuchadnezzar probably could not see what everybody was doing, but he did not have to see all the people. As with any powerful person, he had servants, toadies, who would come and tattle on others if anybody did not obey him. And so the Chaldeans, a group of the king's wise men, accused three men of not bowing before the image. Let's read verses 8 through 12. It says, "Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up.'" So these Chaldeans used the Hebrews' refusal to bow as an opportunity to slander their loyalty to the king. They remind Nebuchadnezzar that these men were foreign slaves and captives. They accuse him of not honoring the king, of not giving to him the respect he deserved. They said they do not serve the gods of Nebuchadnezzar. They're accusing the Hebrews of not being team players. They're stressing that these Hebrews are not like the rest of the Babylonians. They did not fit. They did not really belong. And most importantly, they did not worship the image set up by the king. These three Hebrews, in their opinion, were disobedient, rebellious, troublemakers. I think there's a hint that they would breed disloyalty among the officials, enrage the gods, and endanger the empire. And Nebuchadnezzar was infuriated. His command had been scorned. His God had been spurned. And he would not put up with such insurrection. So in verse 13, it says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" So Nebuchadnezzar commands these rebels be brought to him. He demanded to know from them if it was true that they had refused to bow before his image. And he declares he's going to give them a second chance. I imagine he is thinking this is mercy that he's offering to them. And when they heard the music, they had better worship the idol. If they did not, then they would be thrown into the fire. And then Nebuchadnezzar asked the question. This question is almost at the center of the chapter, and it is at the heart of this story. Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Nebuchadnezzar imagines his power is so great and the gods so unconcerned that nothing can stop him from executing these Hebrews. His question is rhetorical. He's declaring that no deity could or would save them from his wrath. Who is the God who will deliver you? The book of Daniel is the answer to that question. The Jews who first read this book were subjugated and captive people. They were worshipers of the one true God, but they had been defeated by the wicked worshipers of pagan gods. Some of them at least had to be asking themselves, who was God? Where was God? Would God deliver them from their captivity? Nebuchadnezzar probably was thinking, if the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was not able to deliver them from defeat and captivity to Nebuchadnezzar, then he certainly could not deliver them from the fiery furnace. This chapter here, this story is a marvelous testimony of bold obedience to God. However, the stakes in this chapter are more than the obedience of the Hebrews. The most important issue is the character of God. Who is the God who will deliver the Hebrews? And their answer shows that these men had backbones of titanium. They were not cowed by the king's threat. They were not daunted by being made a spectacle in front of all of the other officials. They did not tremble before the king, his court, his God, or his furnace. They told the king, verse 16, "We have no need to answer you in this matter." In other words, what they've already done speaks for itself. They understood the command and the consequences of disobedience the first time. They were not confused. They were not in doubt about what to do. They had made their decision a long time ago about worshiping idols. They were not going to change their minds now. There was no discussion necessary. They were not going to bend to the will of the king because they had already purposed in their hearts to do the will of their God. Their king questioned the character and the power of their God. They did not. They did not ask themselves, who is God? They knew their God. And because they knew their God, the king's question was irrelevant. Because they knew their God, the outcome of their trial was irrelevant. Look at verse 17. It says, "If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O God. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." They told the king, if it was the case that their refusal to bow meant they would be thrown into the furnace, then their God was able to deliver them. They had absolutely no doubts about the power of their God. They knew their God had delivered David from the lion and the bear and the giant. They knew he could deliver them. They knew their God had delivered Israel from Egypt, from starvation and dehydration in the desert. They knew their God was able to deliver them. They knew his power. The threats of the king against them and the insinuations of the king against their God could not shake their conviction in the power of God. They knew their God was able to deliver them, but their obedience to God was not dependent on his delivering them. They were confident he would, but even if he did not, they would not disobey God by obeying the king. They had the brass to look their conqueror and king in the eyes and say, "We do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." I don't know if we can imagine what courage it took to do that in that situation. And they looked him straight in the eyes and said, "We're not going to do it." They had the spiritual and the moral fortitude to let nothing deter them from complete and full obedience to God. But this strength of character did not suddenly appear in them in that trial. They had shown and had developed spiritual gumption from the beginning. Early in their captivity, they refused to eat the food given to them by the king. They would not defile themselves for any man. Their commitment to God continued when they were threatened with death because their incompetent co-workers could not tell the king his dream. They did not respond then with fear. They did not wonder if God had abandoned them. They turned to God in prayer. In the first instance, God blessed their obedience. He made them better looking and healthier than all their fellow students in the Babylonian school. He gave them more wisdom than all of the other captives, their teachers and the wise men of Babylon. In the second instant, God answered their prayers. He told them the content of the king's dream, and he revealed to them the meaning of the dream. When Nebuchadnezzar said, "Who is the God?" they could have given him a lengthy lecture of who their God is. They could have told Nebuchadnezzar their God is the only creator of all things. He is the one who promised to send a deliverer from sin. They could have told him he is Jehovah, Jehovah God, merciful, gracious, long-suffering, and abounding in goodness and truth. They could have told the king how their God parted the Red Sea and the Jordan River for his people. They could have told the king how their God conquered Canaan, embarrassed the gods of the people, healed the sick, raised the dead, established kings, and overthrew kingdoms. They could have told Nebuchadnezzar who the God is who would deliver them. And they knew him and were fully convinced that he alone is God. As a result, they trusted him from the beginning. They grew in that obedience, and they would not bow before any idols, no matter what. Who is God? That is a question that we all face at times in our lives. We at times find ourselves pressured to disobey God. We find ourselves in circumstances in which we feel like God has abandoned us. We find ourselves weighing the cost of obedience and wondering if it is really worth it. And oftentimes we struggle with those big questions because we did not settle obedience to God in the little things. We often casually drift into living as if God and his will do not matter that much. We often find it doesn't take a lot of pressure to convince us to disregard God's command. Sometimes we disobey just because we want to, because somebody else wants us to, because someone might look funny at us if I don't obey God. Sometimes we disobey God because it's easier to disobey than it is to do what God says. So many times we're ready to disobey if we have to choose between obedience and recreation or obedience and what I wanted to do in the first place. We are ready to disobey to God if obedience might make us feel a little foolish or if it would somehow interfere with my plans. But if God is real, if God is truly the only God, and if God is the ruler of heaven and earth, as Daniel has been telling us, then obedience to him should be our greatest concern. Disobedience to God should be unthinkable to us. We ought to be willing to die, literally, before we disobey God. And Jesus himself sets the example for us. The first recorded temptation in the wilderness was the temptation to turn the stone to bread. And Jesus responded to Satan by saying, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." At that point, Jesus had been 40 days without food. He was severely malnourished, on the verge of starving to death. Yet his answer to Satan declared he would rather die than submit to Satan's counsel. He would rather die than displease his father. Do you wonder how those saints of old had the courage to endure torture and martyrdom without denying Jesus? Do you wonder how these three men had the courage to defy the king? And in every case, they were able to obey God when it mattered most, because they had learned to obey him when it didn't seem to matter so much. They obeyed God when it was just a matter of food. I'm convinced that if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had eaten the king's food, they would have worshipped the king's idol. They obeyed in the lesser things and consequently were equipped to obey in the greater things. And it is the way that we obey God, the way we obey God in the big moments when the stakes are highest, is to first obey God in the little things, the daily things. Love your wife. Submit to your husband. Speak kindly to and about others. Practice humility. Pay your taxes. Put on your seatbelt. Study your Bible. Pray. Just be diligent to obey God every day. Do not slip into unthinking disobedience. Do not just do what is easiest or what you've always done. Commit to careful, intentional obedience to God in all things. A life of careless disobedience does not equip us for a moment of courageous obedience. To obey God in the big things, you must obey Him in all the little things.